Okay, we have a few announcements to make. The principal of which... Can you hear in the back? Okay. There's a reception sponsored by Dialogue. This evening during the dinner hour, it's to say farewell to the outgoing editors and welcome the new ones. And it will be held in the Town Hall restaurant, which is adjacent to Annabelle's restaurant. During our session right now, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Stanley Hauerwas, who teaches religion and ethics at Duke University. And I have just a few things that I've gotten from some of his books that I'd just like to say. One thing is that he wishes to be faithful to the office of theology and service rather than just another thinker. So he says that he must think and write not only for the church that does exist, but also for the church that should exist if we were more courageous and faithful. Another thing is that Dr. Hauerwas is not a Mormon. He had someone coming up and asking him earlier. He is, he claims, a Southern Methodist of doubtful theological background. When you are a Methodist, that goes without saying you have a doubtful theological background. And at one point, he taught and worshipped with and was sustained morally and financially by Roman Catholics. But he does believe that the most nearly faithful form of Christian witness is best exemplified by the often unjustly ignored people called Anabaptists or Mennonites. And because of this theological background, he says some people find it hard to pin down his position. And today he's going to be talking about compassion in his paper called Killing Compassion, Why Churches Shouldn't Serve Good Causes.
Thank you very much, Hinckley. I keep mispronouncing your first name, Hinckley. Hinckley. I just discovered that Hinckley is going to be in Durham over the next 4 or 5 years, as her husband's going to be doing his PhD in our Romance language program. So it'll be nice to make an initial friend here. I hope I make a few friends here, though what I have to say is not oftentimes received joyously. What you have before you, I say that as Hinckley read my ecclesial identification, I identify myself usually as a high church Mennonite, which is a little like, which actually I think Methodism ought to be. Unfortunately, Methodism has been fairly washed out. I say that now that I'm back among the Methodists, I have discovered that the Methodists do have a conviction. It's that God is nice, and that and since we're a sanctificationist holiness people, well, we think we ought to be nice too, and I don't believe in niceness, and therefore it makes me something of a heretic among the Methodists. I mean, how would you like to be friendly all the time? It's a terrible way for people to have to live. And so I don't come necessarily being friendly here either. Because it's a little like I taught for 14 years at Notre Dame, and my primary vocation there was to try to save the Catholics from becoming like us. And I don't know how that necessarily fits into your agendas in that way. And what you will hear, this paper isn't written to you because I don't know you. I say that with a good deal of pain. As you know, most mainstream Protestant Christians think Mormons at best are just weird, or at worst right-wing Republicans. Therefore, we've not taken you seriously as a fellow Christian brothers and sisters, and my education reflects that. I really don't know who you are, so I don't have many close Mormon friends either. So that makes a lot of difference for what's happening. So what this paper is actually an attack upon Christianity as I know it. Whether it fits in and to problematics that you are experiencing, I'll be looking forward to being informed by you if, in fact, that's the case. I certainly hope to leave time for questions, and we can have the discussion afterward. I first became aware that compassion can kill by watching a film sponsored by the National Association for Retarded Citizens. The film shows a couple looking into a crib. The room is dark, and we do not know who is in the crib. The young mother looks up at us and says, "Don't let this happen to you. Our baby was born retarded. Our lives are crushed, and we do not know where to turn. Do not let this happen to you. Get prenatal counseling. Help eliminate retardation." I was absolutely stunned by that commercial. It had been developed with the best intentions. The National Association for Retarded Citizens thought this was a way to mobilize support for research monies from the government to help find cures for retardation. Just as people think that we ought to try to eliminate cancer, it is assumed so we ought to try to eliminate retardation. Of course, there's one difficulty. We can care for the cancer patient by trying to alleviate their cancer without destroying the patient. But you cannot eliminate retardation without destroying the person who is retarded. I began to reflect on what could possibly fuel this extraordinary desire to eliminate the retarded in the name of compassion for them. For there is no question that the most compassionate motivation often lays behind calls to eliminate retardation, for helping the old to die without pain, for ensuring that no unwanted children be born, and so on and so on. Such policies seem good because we assume compassion requires us to try to rid the world as much as possible of unnecessary suffering. Those born retarded seem to be suffering from outrageous fortune, cruel fate that, if possible, should be eliminated. Ironically, in the name of responding to suffering, compassion quite literally becomes a killer. Nowhere do we see this more powerfully than issues raised through the practice of medicine today. For modern medicine has had its task change from care to cure in the name of compassion, a killing compassion. For example, the recent discussion of doctor-assisted suicide, which probably ought to be called doctor-assisted suicide, surely must be seen in this context. Unable to cure those who are dying, we then think it is the compassionate alternative to help them to their deaths. Euthanasia thus becomes the other side of the medical and technological imperative to keep people alive at all cost. I mean, one of the things I do when I talk to lay audiences, and by lay audiences I mean people who aren't doctors, because that's the true priesthood today. I mean, you can tell that when I teach at a divinity school, and if a kid comes to the divinity school and says, "Gee, I'm just not really into Christology this year. I'm really into relating. Take some more CPE," or that's clinical pastoral education. We say, "Right, go do it. Go take some more psychology, because after all, that's what the ministry really is. It's relating. So go do that." If a kid comes to medical school today and says, "I'm just really not into anatomy this year. I'm really into relating. I'd like to take some more psychology courses," they say, "Who in the hell are you, kid? We don't care what your interests are. You're going to take anatomy or ship out." Now, how do you explain the difference in that regard? Namely, the difference is that no one thinks that incompetent priests might damage their salvation, but people do think an incompetent doctor can hurt them. Now, that's the reason why medical education is so much more serious moral training today than people in the ministry, because we can form their lives. We can talk them out of their interest in that way. Now, why is that the case? Well, if I ask you how you want to die, for example, most people in modernity will tell you they want to die quickly, in their sleep, painlessly and without being a burden on anyone else. Is that right? That's how you want to die, isn't it? Well, that only shows you how corrupt you are. Now, in the Middle Ages, the thing that people feared the most was sudden death. Why did they fear sudden death? Because they couldn't have time, if they died suddenly, to reconcile themselves with their neighbor and with their God, and therefore to rightly prepare for what it meant to meet God. Now, you see, therefore, what we do today is we want doctors to keep us alive to the point that when we die, we're so out of it, we don't have to know we're dying. And then we blame them for keeping us alive to no point. And then we say, you've kept us alive to no point, now we want you to kill us. See, I mean, that's the kind of funny spiral that you begin to get in. So euthanasia simply becomes the other side of extraordinary life-saving technology that is meant to, I mean, because the one thing that modern people, most modern people, I must say not around Utah because you're probably not modern people. And I say that quite seriously. I mean, I've never heard people use theological language so directly in a non-embarrassed way in years than I've heard around here today. So you're probably not modern people in that way. But most modern people are practical atheists. I mean, most of the time we live our lives as if God does not exist. It works out okay. On the whole, but as people that are practical atheists, we don't necessarily believe in God, but we sure as hell believe in death, and we don't like it. And so primarily what we're about today is medicine is about the theodical project of helping modern people assure the fact that on the whole they can get out of this life alive, and it doesn't work, and then we blame doctors for it in that way. Now. And therefore, we get caught up in this extraordinary thing that we're going to help people by eliminating them. Now, there is a kind of madness in this respect in our modern souls when we confront the suffering of our world. How do you work to care for some when not all can be cared for? We thus work to save starving children, and by keeping them alive, we even have more children that cannot be fed. Thus, compassion perpetuates cruelty, and we're driven mad by that knowledge. Some, in their madness, turn to strategies that require them to sacrifice present generations in the hope of securing a better future for those that are left, all in the name of compassion. The philosophical name that can be given to this form of compassion is called utilitarianism. Even though utilitarianism is often thought to be a radical secular philosophical alternative, in fact, it can be seen as a form of Christianity gone mad. For the utilitarian is radically self-denying, exactly to the extent that the consistent utilitarian gives themselves or those near to them no more value than anyone else. So each person is equal to every other person. That is, as but another unit seeking to maximize their self-interest. Utilitarianism is radically disinterested in that way. That's the reason why so many religious ethicists around today confuse the Christian sense of agape with utilitarian disinterestedness and think that Rawls's concept of justice will nicely translate into what Christians mean by love. It's all crazy, but there's a lot of it. Utilitarians are people that believe in the greatest good for the greatest number, irrespective of who the number is. Utilitarianism, with the greatest compassion, are thus willing to sacrifice some, which may even include themselves, so that the greater number may always flourish. Of course, as is well known, you have the difficulty of knowing who is to count as the greatest number and over what time sequence. Confronted with this kind of killing compassion, one is tempted to quite literally kill compassion. Years ago, I published an article called Love's Not All You Need, in which I attacked those who construed the nature of the Christian moral life primarily in terms of love. When compassion becomes the overriding virtue linked with liberal political practice, it cannot help but be destructive. I mean, I oftentimes think that Protestant liberalism, of course, basically makes, since we don't believe Jesus is God, we have to do something with him because he's there. And so we turn him into this great teacher who you know, had this terrible experience out there in the wilderness and came back like saying, I've had this extraordinary set of experiences in the desert. And, well, I've had an extraordinary insight that I want to share with all of you. The insight is, well, God wants us to love one another. Now, why in the hell would you kill someone like that? I mean, why in the world would that guy end up on a cross? I mean, you'd build him a crystal palace, wouldn't you? I mean, that kind of stupidity, of course, is said both by Protestant liberals and Protestant conservatives who think that what Christianity is about is generally being kind, loving, etc. However, as Oliver O'Donovan has observed in his book, Begotten, Not Made, about compassion, compassion, he says, is the virtue of being moved to action by the sight of suffering. That is to say, by the infringement of passive freedoms. It is a virtue that circumvents thought since it prompts us to immediate action. It is a virtue that presupposes that an answer has already been found to the question what needs to be done, a virtue of motivation, therefore, rather than of reasoning. As such, it is the appropriate virtue for the liberal revolution, which requires no independent thinking about the object of morality, only a very strong motivation to its practice. It is not my intention to try to defeat the overdetermined emphasis upon compassion by both religious and non-religious persons in our society today by suggesting the negative results in societies like ours that pertains. There is no question that charity is, in Aquinas' phrase, the form of all the virtues. But that charity is first and foremost disciplined by the witness of a God who would have us die, yea, even our children die, rather than to live unworthily. Therefore, Christians are formed by a harsh and dreadful love, but one we think that is truthful, rather than the generalized forms of sentimentality that we call compassion. By calling attention, however, to the preponderance of this notion of compassion as the very center of the moral life, I want to help us locate those stories that hold us captive. For there can be no question that the generalized commitment to compassion, characteristic of Enlightenment societies, forms Christians as well as the non-Christian soul in modernity. My way of putting that matter is that today we are all liberals. We are such because we have no choice but to be such. It was the project of modernity to create social orders that would produce something called the free individual. The powerful institution of that was the division of labor, as that made it impossible to escape the fate of being an individual whose sole moral focus was that of compassion. Put quite simply, the story of modernity is that you should have no story except the story you have chosen when you had no story. The story of modernity is that you should have no story except the story you chose when you had no story. If you don't believe that that's the working ethic of the United States of America, I read to you from the most recent Supreme Court decision about abortion, the Casey decision in Pennsylvania. Justice Kennedy, who wrote the decision, or conservative justice, says that abortion liberty is at the heart of what it means to be an American because, quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of universe, and of the mystery of human life. You should have no story except the story you chose when you had no story. Therefore, the object of, that's the object that creates the liberal arts college in America. The liberal arts college in America is to free you from the limits of your family, where you will learn you don't buy Elvis on black velvet, you buy, as a matter of fact, Van Gogh prints, and we call that freedom. I mean, the liberal arts college is about alienating you from your tradition in the name of telling you you are now not product of any tradition other than the one you want to get to make up your mind about. That's what university education on the whole is about in America. It's about corrupting the American youth. In that sense, the most disastrous film that has been on the scene recently, of course, is the Dead Poets Society, where you see this young creative teacher helping these 17 to 18 year old kids in this posh private school in New England come to a sense of their own autonomy, helping them learn to make up their own minds, etc., etc., etc. And we all rejoice at this. We all celebrated it when we saw it. I mean, that's crazy. What you ought to tell any 17 and 18-year-old in this society is they don't have a mind worth making up. The idea that they're going to have a choice to choose between Plato and Aristotle only convinces them that, as a matter of fact, ideas are just another further part of the capitalist economy, and they get to buy those that suit them. I mean, so what university education is about is inscribing people into capitalist presuppositions and habits, where, as a matter of fact, they won't know that the story they've chosen has, in fact, chosen them. That's and we call that freedom. Thus, the modern presupposition that one should never be held, I mean, what the presumption is, you should never have a story except the story you've chosen when you had no story. Thus, the modern presumption that one should never be held responsible for commitments which we have not freely chosen, even if we thought at the time we were freely choosing them. I mean, that's a very strong modern presumption, isn't it? Don't you have that? I shouldn't be held responsible for decisions I made when I didn't know what I was doing, when I later look back and it's clear I didn't know what I was doing. I shouldn't be held responsible for those. Compassion and the creation of compassionate societies tries to make it possible for each person in a society of individuals to have the social, economic, and political status to choose who they want to be. That is what compassion, the object of compassion, is. The project of liberal societies, therefore, is quite simply to make freedom of choice a necessity. Thus, we achieve the goal of making freedom the fate of each individual. That Rousseau saw clearly that's what he wanted to do. I mean, that was the notion, that creation of modern societies is where people are fated to be free. Then, of course, then what do you do with that fate? That, of course, creates the peculiar form of self-deception at the heart of the modern project. For ironically, what liberal societies cannot acknowledge is that we did not choose the story, that we should have no story except the story we have chosen from the position we had no story. Who told you that story? And why did you accept it? See, it's become your fate. I'm fortunate, perhaps like you're fortunate to be a Mormon, you knew you had no choice. I'm fortunate because I'm a Texan. I knew I had no choice, and it worked out fine. You need to have a sense of what it means to be fated in that way. Therefore, modern liberal societies cannot acknowledge that they are coercive, since they derive their legitimation from the presumption that no one, if they have appropriate social and economic power, is coerced to be a member of such social orders. And we want to continue to create the expansion of that freedom. This, of course, renders problematic some of our most basic practices, as they cannot help but appear unintelligible as liberal and compassionate grounds. For example, when I taught at the University of Notre Dame, they had a marriage course in the curriculum, and I did not want to miss the opportunity to teach such a course, but I knew how I did it would be disappointment for both the parents who wanted their children to take the course as well as the students that took it. For I knew that the parents would want the course taught from the perspective of how to do it, and I could only teach the course from the perspective of why would you want to. After all, marriage for Christians is not a necessity, since we believe our lives as Christians do not require marriage and even progeny, since now our true family is the church. I mean, that's the most remarkable separation of Christianity from Judaism. Didn't have anything, I mean, it certainly had to do with our worship of Jesus, which, of course, is idolatry on Jewish grounds. But the most decisive practice with which Christians broke from Jews was the assumption that you did not have to be married to be a follower of Christ and a worshiper of Christ God, who is also the God of Israel. Why was that the case? Why is it because that Christians had this supposedly negative attitude toward sex? That certainly became part of it later. Though, I mean, most Christians understood that sex isn't evil, it's just complex. And knew that you had to think of the appropriate ways to deal with that complexity in that way. No, the reason that Christians were freed from being married and having children is now they understood that their true family is the church that lives by hope, not through ascription of children. You can be pretty sure that Christians no longer believe the gospel is true just to the extent that they make marriage and the family an idolatrous institution necessary for everyone in the church. Because now we're afraid to witness to the outsider that we would like them to be part of the joy that we have experienced, so instead we'd just rather acclimate our children into it. See, I mean, when I used to teach this marriage course, I'd read the kids a letter. It said, gee, our son had done well. He'd gone to good schools, had been in the military, had gotten out, looked like he's going to have a bright political career. And he's been converted by some Near Eastern religious sect and doesn't want anything to do with us because we're people of the world. And he's never going to marry because now he says that his true family is this group of people. We're just heartsick. What should we do? And I'd say, who wrote that letter? And they'd say, well, we guess it's parents of a kid who's gone to the Moonies or the Hare Krishnas or something. It's a compilation of 4th-century Roman senatorial families about their son's conversion to Christianity. People forget that Christians are the Moonies of the Roman Empire, and the Romans were right. The Romans were right. We were about the destruction of the family. Why do you think Ronald Reagan is pro-family? Because he wants the kids for the armies. That's why we Christians don't believe in armies. Or if we do, it requires special justification. So the fact that, you know, I mean, of course conservatives and fascists are always pro-family. But we Christians aren't. We Christians aren't. So, you see, I mean, this made a difference for how I taught the marriage course. However, trying to satisfy as many as possible, I knew the students had been sent to Notre Dame because it had the reputation of being a relatively conservative school. By conservative, most meant that students at Notre Dame would be taught some absolutes. Not wanting to disappoint these expectations, I always taught an absolute that I call Hauerwas's Law. Hauerwas's Law is you always marry the wrong person. Though such a law sounds cynical, it is not, in fact, meant to be such, since it's also reversible. You also always marry the right person. You just have to learn to get along with it. Now, I did not teach Hauerwas's Law simply to challenge the romantic conceptions of marriage shared by both my students and their parents alike. How could you possibly think at 22 or 23 you knew what you were doing when you chose someone else to marry? How could you do that? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you're clearly, I mean, you don't even know who you are. I'm not even sure. I'm 52. I keep waiting to grow up. What would it mean? Rather, I taught Hauerwas's Law to challenge some of the basic liberal presuppositions that I thought was destroying the very notion of marriage as an institution and practice characteristic of Christians. For it is the peculiar sensibility of modernity to think if our marriages have gone bad, it is because we did not know what we were doing when we chose the person we married. If we just become more intelligent and more thoughtful, we will get it right the second time, surely. I mean, the anomaly being, of course, is that people oftentimes marry people very similar to their first spouse. Sadistic and masochistic habits are very hard to break. And, I mean, I would rather live in contexts that I'm familiar. Of course, the anomaly behind this set of presuppositions is that one can never know what one was doing when one got married. Indeed, I take it that the wisdom of the Christian tradition has been that we marry people not because we think that they know what they are doing, but because they do not. That is why Christians should insist that you can only have your marriage blessed by the church among people who can hold you to your promises. I mean, we are in the Protestant world today. We marry people we don't know who want a church wedding. It's crazy. I mean, why would you possibly do that? I mean, obviously what you tell these people when they get married, you do not know what you're doing, but we're going to hold you to it. That's the reason why we're going to marry you. See, because we think that you may be the kind of person that is ready to be responsive to church authority in a way that will be able to accept the disciplines necessary to maintain the marriage. That's what it's about. Of course, the other anomaly that the liberal presuppositions create about marriage and the family is the unintelligibility we feel for our children, as well as the children's responsibility for their parents. Why should you be responsible for people you did not choose as part of your life in the first place? I mean, one of the terrors is being a wanted child. How could you possibly know what it means to want this person who turns out not to be the person you wanted, and you're stuck with them? It is an awful circumstance, and therefore you thought if you just saved enough money, if you just had enough education ahead of time, and if you had the college funds all set, it was going to be okay. It's not okay. It doesn't work. I mean, because who wants to have to live out the pattern of being wanted in that way? Rather, what most of us discover is that our parents as well as our children are simply given to us, and we must learn to be stuck with them, and in being so stuck, we learn that our lives graciously are not our own. Yet it's exactly such limits that the compassionate imperative of liberalism to create a society where we're freed from such fate renders problematic. That is why liberal compassion has so much difficulty understanding why we have obligations to near neighbors who come in the form of our children in a manner that those obligations cannot be overridden for the good of future generations. Of course, the kind of obligation we have to our children does not mean that we have that they can have computers while children in Somalia are starving. The difficulty we face, however, is that we do not know how to say or express our care for our children in Somalia without underwriting the liberal project of compassion. We thus throw up our hands, acknowledging if we cannot do everything necessary to make the world free of starving children, then we might as well do nothing and buy our children computers. Other anomalies of the liberal project of compassion are found in areas such as education. Thus, the task of education in most liberal societies becomes that of providing information for children to make up their own minds. The most feared perversion of such education we call indoctrination. It never seems to occur to us that in the name of respecting students' individual desires, we indoctrinate them to believe that their own individual desires should matter. Any education that is worthy is obviously indoctrination and formation. Our inability to acknowledge it as such in the name of respect and love for the student is but a sign of our corruption and also the fear of our own convictions. So I tell my students, from divinity school students through graduate students, but by the time they finished working with me, I want them to be able to think just like me. Now that sounds authoritarian, doesn't it? You think, oh, I can't believe that anyone would say that. But at least they know they've got a battle on their hands. I'm not manipulating them into letting them think that they get to make up their minds. I want them to know the arguments against Rawls' theory of justice work. They can't. No one writes a dissertation on Rawls under me. They go somewhere else. I mean, the idea that somehow or the other, you know, you're going to let them do what they want to do is deeply. I mean, what are you there for? Why am I getting paid to do this? I mean, it is a vocation. Now, it would not serve us well to continue to try to document the anomalies created by societies dominated by the liberal virtue of compassion. More important, I think, is for us to try to understand why this story of liberal compassion so grips our lives. For when I critique liberal societies, I do not assume that liberalism is somehow out there and not in my own soul. For one way or the other, we have all become liberals, and we all think accordingly our primary moral virtue should be that of compassion. In his Sources of the Self, The Making of Modern Identity, Charles Taylor makes some extreme observations, I believe, that help us understand how we have all become liberals. One of the major aspects of modern identity he calls the discovery for the affirmation of ordinary life. By ordinary life, he means, quote, those aspects of human life concerned with production and reproduction, that is, labor, the making of things needed for life, and our life as sexual beings, including marriage and the family. Taylor is not making the absurd claim that prior to modernity, people did not love their children or marry for love. Nor prior to modernity did they value less their everyday work. People of all ages and societies have cared for their children, though what care meant can obviously vary a great deal. It is not the actual place of affection that Taylor is calling to our attention, but rather the sense of its importance. For as he says, what changes is not that people begin loving their children or feeling affection for their spouses, but that these dispositions come to be seen as a crucial part of what makes life worthy and significant. For whereas previously these dispositions were taken as banal, except perhaps that their absence in a marked degree might cause concern or condemnation, now they are seen as endowed with crucial significance. It is, of course, true that beginning to make something of them already alters these dispositions. Taylor notes that Aristotle managed to combine in his account of the eudaimonistic life, that is, the life of happiness, two activities: theoretical contemplation and participation as a citizen in the polity. Yet Plato looked unfavorably on the second, and the Stoics challenged both. At least for some of the Stoics, the sage should be detached from the fulfillment of his vital and sexual needs as part of being able to live a higher life. Taylor calls our attention to Aristotle and Plato and the Stoics' conceptions of these matters to note, in contrast to the valuing of ordinary life, stands those forms of social existence that are extrinsically hierarchical. It is the life of contemplation and political participation, the latter often exemplifying the aristocratic ethic of honor, that renders the minor householder as inferior. Quite frankly, when I wrote this, I didn't know the valence of the language of hierarchy among Mormons. I didn't know that that was part of your discourse. And so I'm not necessarily, as Hinckley reminded, I'm not, when I say hierarchy, I'm not talking about men in dark suits and red ties. When I say hierarchy, what I'm talking about are societies that assume that there are forms and practices of life that render what Taylor calls the affections of family, everyday work, etc., secondary to those forms of life. That there are other things that you are called to do. Taylor notes that the transition he thinks so significant is when these hierarchies are displaced in favor of labor and production on the one hand and marriage and family life on the other. All previous higher activities are now rendered problematic. For example, under the impact of the scientific revolution, the intellectual project of grasping the order of the cosmos through contemplation is now seen as vain. Rather, now the object is to engage in the detailed work of discovery. Accordingly, Francis Bacon reorientates science to be about relieving the condition of man, not understanding the beauty of planetary motion. science is no longer a higher activity which ordinary life should subserve. On the contrary, science should benefit ordinary life. Thus, the impossibility of justifying the life of the philosopher in our society. So you just simply cannot do it. According to Taylor, inherent in this new evaluation of ordinary life is a commitment toward social leveling. The good life is about what everyone can or should achieve. The elitism of the ethic of the gentleman, the ethic of honor, is slowly eroded in favor of virtues necessary to sustain the life of commerce, the sciences that serve that commerce, and for the goods of work and family. Even or especially revolutionary thought such as Marxism has as its goal to find our highest dignity in labor and the transformation of nature in service of life. Taylor argues that to rightly understand the transformation of the significance of ordinary life, we cannot attribute that just to the process of secularization. Indeed, Taylor suggests that the origin of this discovery of the everyday came first and foremost from the Reformation. For it was one of the central points of the Reformation to reject mediation. In particular, the Reformation criticized the Catholic presumption that some in the corporate body of Christ could be more dedicated, making them capable of winning merit and salvation for others who were less so. Now, that's going to strike at the heart of you and most Protestantism. And you've got to understand how important that is. Because what that says is that salvation is not getting your individual destiny straight. But salvation is a cosmological event of God enacted on the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ, such that a community has been put in the world that you can be received into, whether it makes sense to you or not, and accordingly you are saved, because you have now been made part of that cosmological drama. So that doesn't mean that your own self-understanding will determine the nature of salvation. See, so now Catholics, you see, understood, therefore. I mean, we Protestants get real critical of the Catholics for saying, my God, do you know those people don't know what they're doing at Mass? So what? So what? They're there, and they're being taken up in that extraordinary drama of God's presence in word and sacrament in a way that is salvation. See, that salvation is extremely material. It palpitates a body in that way. Now, what was lost in the Reformation was that sense of salvation. Now salvation comes to each individual. The rejection of mediation was interconnected with the Reformation denial that the sacred could be found in some places and times more than others. No holy objects, lands, or people. Salvation is now the exclusive work of God, requiring the rejection of the Catholic understanding of the Church as a necessary mediator of God's salvation. The very idea that there were special places or times or communities for action where the power of God is more intensely present became the hallmark of those people called Protestant. When salvation is no longer thought mediated, then all important becomes the personal commitment of the believer. Now, no one can belong to the people of God by one's connection to a wider order that sustains a sacramental life, but now one's wholehearted personal commitment is required. Monasticism, accordingly, is rendered problematic. Monasticism flourished when members of the church drew on the merits of those who are more fully dedicated to the Christian life through the mediation of the church, and because I'm accepting this lower level of dedication, I'm settling for less than a full commitment to the faith. I'm a passenger in the ecclesial ship on its journey to God, but for Protestantism there can be no passengers. This is because there is no ship in the Catholic sense. No common movement carrying humans to salvation, each believer must now row his or her own boat. See, I mean, for a Catholic, it makes all the sense in the world to say, Father, will you pray for me? We don't think it makes sense for us. When I say we, I mean we Protestants. I'm not speaking for Mormons. I don't know how this you hear this. But this is how it's worked out for us. Accordingly, the very notion of vocation changes. While in Catholic cultures the term vocation is used in connection with the priesthood or the monastic life, but for the Puritans, vocation becomes any employment understood as useful to mankind and imputed to use by God. The highest life can no longer be defined by the exalted kind of activity. It all turns on the spirit in which one lives, what everyone lives, and the most mundane existence. Such a view of vocation assumes that the Creator intends the preservation of all creatures. Humans serve God's purposes in taking the appointed means to preserve themselves in being. This doesn't mean that we're called upon to preserve others at our own expense. It is no question of renunciation. Whether we're called upon to serve both ourselves and others as being equally humans and God's creatures. Vocation, thus, is alleged to have intrinsic rules, orders of creation, sovereign spheres that the believer must submit to as part of their service in their vocation. So you get, of course, I was just doing my job running the trains on time, Adolf Eichmann. R. George Bush. Taylor argues that it was not accidental that the Puritan, I mean George Bush no doubt would say, you know, there are things I have to do as president that I really wouldn't do as a Christian. Doesn't he? Don't you say there are some things that I have to do as a business person that I wouldn't do as a Mormon? If you say that, you are a Lutheran, not a Mormon, I think. You see how this distinction between what I have to do in my vocation, etc., which is worthy in itself, and what I must do as a Christian, is now made distinct by this value. I mean, it's now thought valid given this valuing of everyday life. Taylor argues that it was not accidental that the Puritan discovery of the theology of work in ordinary life provided a hospitable environment for scientific revolution. Bacon's outlook on science was in fact made possible by those Puritan presuppositions. Baconian science and Puritan theology equally rebelling against traditional authority, which is merely feeding on its own errors and is returning to its neglected source. The scriptures on the one hand, experimental reality on the other. See, one of the odd things that we're facing today is that higher criticism and fundamentalism in our communities are just two sides of the same coin. Both of them think that the scriptures can be read denuded of Christian tradition. The fundamentalists just think there are the facts there. The higher critic just thinks if they get good enough at historical reconstruction, they'll find out what they really meant. The text don't mean anything. The text don't mean anything. The meaning comes, I mean, meaning isn't very interesting. It's how they are used for the upbuilding of a good community. Baconian science and Protestant fundamentalism are the same thing. They both believe in uninterpreted facts. Both appealed to what they saw as living experience against dead received doctrines. The experience of personal conversion and commitment and that of direct observation of nature's workings. Remember, Protestantism thought, basically what Protestantism has done is said, we have the New Testament and now. I mean, that's how we get taught what Protestantism is about. Science is the same thing. You got facts and now. You don't need to know the history of a science in order to know how to do biochemistry. I think that's a false view, by the way. But it's what we recapitulate in our universities every day. That you don't know the history of a science in order to know what you're doing now. We do the same thing with our theologies. Baconian science thus institutionalized the shift from contemplation as the goal of science to science becoming the means for humans to be the stewards of God's creation. Accordingly, Baconian science served to legitimate an instrumental stance toward the world, which ironically made science all the more powerful as it's now filled with spiritual meaning. Now our task through science is to gain rational control over ourselves and the world for the good of the world. See, we don't contemplate it anymore, we use it. Instrumentalizing is crucial to this approach to the world since we're constantly reminded to treat the things of creation merely as instruments and not as ends valuable in themselves. Taylor argues, as a result, the tremendous importance of the instrumental stance in modern culture is overdetermined. It represents the conversion of more than one string. It is supported not just by the new science and not just by the dignity attaching to the disengaged rational control. It has also been central to the ethic of ordinary life from its theological origins on. Affirming ordinary life has meant valuing the efficacious control of things by which it is preserved and enhanced, as well as valuing the detachment from purely personal enjoyments, which would blunt our dedication to its general flourishing. Now, what's interesting is when you're around modern physicists, they don't really care what their physics results in. If you talk to a physicist, they'll say such a theory is so elegant. They use aesthetic categories. they don't care if it works in any interesting way. But unfortunately, the shape of the ideology of science is put into the instrumental mode. Now, it was this form of rationalized Christianity called deism that resulted from these developments. The Puritan stress to work for the common good becomes the Enlightenment presumption that there is a way of life which can conciliate self-service and beneficence. Just to the extent that our service to the self can take productive form, such service can be furthered without invading others' right and property. The Puritan presumption that our purpose to worship God is now translated into living rationally, that is, productively. Instrumental rationality now becomes the avenue of participation in God's will. This is not an abasement of God's will to the status of a factor in our game, but rather it exalts our reasoning to a level of collaboration in God's very purpose. Thus, the affirmation of ordinary life went hand in hand with the notion that the very purpose of God's creation was for the human good. This took the form of a belief in the good order of nature. Miracles, in fact, had to be excluded not simply because the presumptions of an ordered universe required that they be eliminated, but because if miracles were a possibility, then we were less sure of developing predictable sciences necessary for serving the human good. Now, that's probably the most important thing I said, and you probably didn't understand it because it's hard. Because what that says is that the reason that we don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead or healed the sick or that St. Francis talked with the birds, we don't believe in miracles because miracles are unpredictable. And the whole point of modernity is to create predictability that will underwrite our science's ability to manipulate the world and therefore create the authority in modernity of the expert. Because what the expert depends upon is the distinction between fact and value that makes the world manipulable so that you will always have predictable results. That's the reason why everyone carries their experts with them today. Namely, the Republicans have their economic experts, the Democrats have their economic experts, and no one will say that no economist knows what in the world is going on. But you see, we become then committed to capitalist economies to thinking that our first responsibility is to always act from our self-interest in order, hopefully, to make economics a predictable science. Greed becomes an obligation because otherwise we wouldn't know how to make gross national product work. I mean, these are serious matters. As a result, you have to exclude miracle. I mean, I'm a pacifist. If you take miracle out of my life, it's unintelligible. See, I mean, the only possibility of being a pacifist is the belief in God's continued working to use our lives in a way that pulls possibilities out of what look like necessity. But we can't have miracle in our world except as a kind of symbol. The great historical events of the Exodus and the cross require that the Christian maintain unbroken continuity with these moments through tradition. However, once the notion of order becomes paramount, it makes no more sense to give them a crucial status in religious life. It becomes an embarrassment, Taylor says, to religion that it should be bound to belief in particular events which divide one group from another or in any case open to cavil. The great truths of religion are all universal. Reason extracts these from the general course of things. A gap separates these realities of universal import on the particular facts of history. These latter cannot support the former. I mean, you believe Joseph Smith was a miracle which made you possible. You cannot make sense of your lives without it. But all the other explanatory modes that you live in your life, want you to know, be able to explain it on causal mechanistic forms. That's what's taught at the University of Utah. I imagine it's taught at Brigham Young. So Christianly, we have not been able to subject our intellectual forms of display to our commitment to miracle. We want to make history a causal set of nexuses that will ensure that we can manipulate it. What is extraordinary about Taylor's analysis is how it helps us see the loss of a Christological center for any Christian account of love. It's necessary not because of science, but because of the moral presuppositions commensurate to the evaluation of everyday life. If we are to create compassionate societies in which the value of each individual is thought to be equal to other individuals, then we must devalue the extraordinary. The extraordinary, of course, comes in the form of extraordinary people as well as extraordinary events. But in the interest of creating a compassionate society, that is, societies that are driven by the imperative technology to render existence as much as possible free of suffering for the good of each individual, we discover that we must live in a world in which the ordinary reigns. Ironically, the story of modernity is that modernity was created by Christianity, which then rendered its creator irrelevant and trivial at best and perverse at worst. Which brings us back to O'Donovan's worries in Begotten Not Made. For O'Donovan has seen clearly how the technological imperatives driven by the ethics of compassion can only end ironically in murder. What do we as Christians have to offer as an alternative to this set of events? According to O'Donovan, there are four things we can do. First, Christians should confess their faith in the natural order as the good order of God's creation. To do this is to acknowledge that there are limits to the employment of technique and limit to the appropriateness of making. These limits will not be taught by compassion, but by only understanding of what God has made and the discovery that it is complete, whole, and satisfying. We must learn again the original meaning of the great symbolic observance of the Old Testament faith, the Sabbath, on which we lay aside our making and acting and doing in order to celebrate the completeness and integrity of God's making and acting and doing, in the light of which we can dare to undertake another week's work. Technique, too, must have its Sabbath rest. Secondly, according to O'Donovan, Christians must confess at this juncture our faith in the providence of God as the ruling power of history. To do this, we must make clear that there are limits to responsibility with regard to the future. The future is not an artifact which we can mold to our will. Rather, we must see that there are ways of acting that contribute to the course of events, a deed which, whatever is the outcome, is fashioned rightly in response to reality which confronts the agent that acts. Third, Christians should confess that our faith is in a transcendent ground if we are to affirm human community at all. In our time, the notion of brotherhood has broken up into two inadequate substitutes. On the one hand, the notion of bearing responsibilities for someone which implies care for the other's freedom without mutuality of action, and on the other hand, the notion of association in a common project which implies mutuality of action without care for the other's freedom. If we are to recover the mutual responsibility between doctor and patient, for example, we need to think of their quality as pro-operating human agents in ways that only the Christian confession can open up to us. Fourthly, Christians should confess their faith that creation from beginning to end is made through the Word, which we call Jesus. Only on that understanding are we capable of acknowledging the kind of order that is rightly found in the world. O'Donovan's suggestions for how we as Christians are to respond to the ethos of compassion are wise and profound. I wish they were adequate. I fear, however, such appeals to order, even created order, and the correlative confession in God's creation that sustained them, because I do not believe such order is knowable apart from cross and resurrection. Where finally what I think O'Donovan seeks is an account of natural law that is not governed by the eschatological witness of Christ's resurrection. We cannot write about, as Oliver did in his book, resurrection and moral order, because any order that we know as Christians is resurrection. I'm not denying that we are creatures of a good creator. I'm simply suggesting that as Christians we know nothing about what we mean by creation separate from the new order we find through the concrete practice of baptism and Eucharist, correlative as they are to Christ's resurrection. That, I think, means, in short, there is no way to protect ourselves from the ethics of compassion by appeals to order guaranteed by God's good creation. I do not care whether you call it orders of creation or sphere of sovereignty or common grace. What must be recognized is the ethos of compassion that currently threatens to destroy us all will not be checked by appeals to the integrity of creation, but rather by people who know that their lives have meaning only as they are called to serve one another through the body and blood of Jesus of Nazareth. Only such a people can know how to love some in a world where not all can be cared for. Indeed, I suspect if Taylor is right, we cannot rescue compassion by appeals to the integrity of nature, but rather we must rediscover that the compassion we know as Christians comes mediated through hierarchy named Jesus. Thank you very much. I see I've gone over, haven't I? I'm sorry, but I'll be here for questions for anyone that wants to do it afterward.
Those people who have questions are invited to go to the hospitality suite. It's room number 194, just north of the harvest room.